I'm Chris Williamson, deputy leader of the Workers' Party, former Labour Party member and Labour MP, but was hounded out of the party because of my support for the Palestinian people and my attempt to try and democratise the party to make the Parliamentary Labour Party accountable to the grassroots.
But Chris, are any of our political parties really democratic? The idea surely is that the membership can determine policy, but that really doesn't seem to happen. I mean, interestingly, recently with Reform, absolutely no interest really by the leadership with the membership inputting. I wonder, you know, are there any of the political parties today where the members really decide policy?
Well, none of the parties sitting in Westminster are democratic. Essentially, they serve the elites, they serve the establishment, the military-industrial complex, the neoliberal elites in the country. And I mean, and maybe ever it was thus, but it certainly got considerably worse, I think, over the last few decades. And, you know, ordinary working-class people, the vast majority of the British public, have lost out as a consequence of that. And this spending review that we saw in Westminster today, I mean, it was a fundamentally dishonest word salad. It goes nowhere near addressing the problems facing the country. And it's really more of the same, I'm afraid to say. You know, kind of long on rhetoric, but short on meaningful action.
Well, look, can you just explain a bit about the so-called consensus? I think that's what most people are aware of, that there is this City of London consensus whereby if you stray outside of that, the you're going to get your I wouldn't say your legs chopped off, but maybe you might just lose your job, that sort of thing. Can you say something about that consensus and who has managed to form that? Because there's very few people seem to be speaking outside it.
Well, that's true, but I mean the establishment has always been very powerful in this country. I think after the Second World War, there was a feeling amongst the establishment that they needed to give some crumbs from the table. It was a bit more than that, if I'm honest. I mean, I think the post-war consensus, which actually saw inequality diminishing every year, a bigger proportion of the national income went into workers' wage packets right the way through to the mid-1970s. But then the new right, the neoliberals, really kind of gained the ascendancy again. This was following the oil crisis in the early 1970s, and they used the excuse that the kind of post-war consensus, the kind of old Keynesian approach to economic problems, wasn't working and we needed a new approach. And, you know, it all went wrong when Denis Seeley went to the International Monetary Fund in 1976, and then the kind of neoliberal monetarist agenda was turbocharged when Thatcher got into office. And what we've seen since that time is more and more deregulation of our services, of particularly the financial institutions, and really a financialization of the economy in this country. I mean, if you think back, Tony, to, I mean, you're probably a bit younger than me, but I guess you might remember the 1970s. You know, there was a lot of people working in manufacturing in this country, but what we've seen over the intervening, nearly 50 years now, is that most of those jobs have been offshored to countries where they can exploit the workers to an even greater extent, basically countries where cheap labour is available. And that has had made a fundamental difference, I think, to the character of Britain. And it certainly made a fundamental difference to the balance of power in the country. I mean, there was a time when, you know, working class people through the trade union movement had some influence on policy in the country. And that has massively waned. And it's not because people fell out of love with the trade union movement necessarily. It was because many of the jobs that were unionised no longer exist in this country. They've been shipped overseas. And
look, Chris, you're a former leader of Derby Council.
Yes.
Derby's a typical city which used to have industry. And maybe you could just tell us a bit about your city, what industries were there in the past and what's there today?
Well, it was based on manufacturing. I mean, it was a huge manufacturing city. I mean, there is still some manufacturing here. I mean, Rolls-Royce is still the biggest employer in the city. I think it has about 11 or 12,000 people working there. But, you know, if you go back 50 years, Rolls-Royce alone employed 35,000 people. When I left school in Derby in 1972, there were 20-odd thousand people working at the railway, 20-odd thousand people working at Celanese, which is a textile company that's been razed to the ground, no longer exists. In fact, well, they're just building some massive warehouses on the site now. But you had manufacturing, you had heavy engineering, you'd got foundries in Derby. You know, around 120,000 manufacturing jobs were available in the city in those days. And you knew when you left school that you were guaranteed employment. You knew as well that you were going to enjoy a better standard of living than your parents did. And that was a product, really, of the post-war consensus that was set in train by that 1945 Labour government under Clem Attlee, you know, that introduced the National Health Service, thanks to, you know, Nye Bevan, who led that, and brought a lot of industries into public ownership. But then, you know, the great sell-off happened. I mean, even Harold Macmillan, the old Tory grandee, railed against what Thatcher was doing, you know, talked about selling off the family silver. You know, we're paying the price now. I mean, you know, we're over-reliant now on the financial sector. It doesn't create that many jobs. It's created a massive problem in relation to housing. That's been exacerbated, of course, by Thatcher's decision to flog off council houses and make it very difficult, penalise indeed local authorities that tried to build new council houses. And so it's stored up a huge problem. And it's also forced up the price of property in the private sector. I mean, you know, you could buy, I mean, look, working class people were able to afford to buy their own homes. You know, when I was a young man, starting out in my late, in fact, I bought a house when I was nine, brand new house, in fact, in a desirable village when I was 19 years of age. And I even had friends in London, actually, which was a little bit more expensive than Derby, but it was still within reach of ordinary working class people. But now, of course, that is no longer the case. And that's because there's been this over-reliance, as I say, on the financial sector. And, you know, and the banking world have been reluctant to invest in manufacturing, in industry, because that's more of a risky investment, isn't it, anyway? And particularly, as many say, many of those industries have been offshored now. And a more solid return for the bankers or the banksters is if you put that money into bricks and mortar, because if the mortgagee can't afford to pay, then they can reclaim the property, you know, and they've got the bricks and mortar, they've got the asset, and you know, so their investment, if you like, is secure. But it's ordinary people that's paid the price of that now. So you know, people say it's difficult to buy. It's very almost impossible in many areas to kind of rent. You know, the price is so in the private sector is so expensive for people, and so lots of people are having to share. People are staying at home with their parents for a lot longer than they used to do, and the whole thing's just messed up. I mean, it really does need a fundamental shift. And
no, that I mean, look, what would you say? Because some people are pointing to over the last 5 years or so, we've been having something like 250,000 migrants coming into the country. I mean, that must surely have a big effect on house prices, because it's a massive increase in demand for housing.
I don't think that's made a big difference to house prices, if I'm honest with you. I think it's made a difference in relation to wage rates and things like that. But there's a more fundamental issue at stake here, it seems to me. I mean, we need a proper industrial strategy. You know, we need a renaissance, it seems to me, in our industrial base. We may not be able to go back to the old days of the manufacturing industries that previously were here. But, you know, but with the new technologies coming on stream, the biosciences and so on, you know, we can excel in that. And I think that's where there needs to be investment. There needs to be investment in housing. I mean, there was some money in the spending review today, but nowhere near enough. No real talk about a renaissance in council housing. I mean, back in the day, even the Tories used to talk about building 300,000 homes a year. In fact, the Tories, if you go back to that post-war consensus period, built more council houses than Labour governments did. But, you know, you have to look about, well, why are people, seeking refuge in the UK in the first place? Well, very often it's as a consequence of Britain's foreign policy and, you know, the involvement in war, arms sales and sanctions, economic sanctions, which impoverish populations. And, you know, what we should be doing is actually stopping the wars, ending the sanctions and stopping the arms sales.
I agree, because sanctions have affected me massively. In that I found it impossible to get work in other parts of the world where previously I did have work. So I actually went to the benefits people a couple of months ago, and I said, well, the problem for me is all the sanctions. And she said, and she looked on the computer and she said, well, it doesn't look to me as if you've had any sanctions. I said, well, actually, no, it's not benefit sanctions I'm talking about. It's government sanctions, which is impossible for me to get work in other parts of the world. But look, we're here to chat about this week's review of spending by Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor. And I think in a minute, what we'll do is we'll look at some of the sort of bigger picture, the big things she's getting wrong, because clearly she is getting things wrong. But I wonder if you could just take a look at the budget last year she brought in, where she's increasing employers' national insurance and the inheritance tax on farms. This is, certainly farmers I've spoken to are absolutely horrified, saying, well, look, we're already having serious problems with the supermarkets, et cetera, and actually making our farms pay. And also, of course, exactly the same with small businesses, where they're saying it's already extremely expensive in this country to employ people. So this is just another disincentive to give people jobs. So before we look at what she said today, what do you make of those two specific measures that were taken?
Well, I mean, I think it was wrong-headed to do that. it certainly isn't going to benefit the country, and it's kind of just fiddling really while Rome burns. And actually, it's worse than that. I mean, it's pouring petrol on the flames. We need a root and branch fundamental shift away from the neoliberal consensus that's held sway now for, as I say, 50 years, really.
So let's talk about that in a minute, the big changes that are needed. But today, for example, and yesterday, new nuclear was announced, and the government will be part funding that. We're not sure where the rest of the money is coming from. But in the background to this, we keep hearing from all these tech giants, from Microsoft, Google, and Meta, that they are, with their AI data centers, needing, basically, they're saying we want nuclear power. And this seems to be part of the decision. But anyway, what do you make of the announcement about Sizewell, that the government says, yes, it's going to get the go-ahead?
I've got kind of mixed feelings about it, if I'm honest with you, personally. I think there may be other solutions that might be more sustainable than going for nuclear. But it's some investment. It will create some jobs, and it will obviously generate a clean-ish energy. I mean, obviously, there is a problem with the nuclear waste and so on. But you made a point, Tony, about how they're going to pay for it, where's the money going to come from? Well, there is no problem for money. I mean, look, the government has got all the money it needs because it issues the currency. The only thing that limits the government's investment is the availability of real resources in the economy, because that will then create inflation. The purpose of taxation and bond sales, I mean, they talk about borrowing. It's not really borrowing. That's a misnomer. It's selling government bonds to wealthy elites and big corporations. It's kind of corporate welfare, if you like. It really is. I mean, it's about controlling inflation. That's what taxation is for. And indeed, really, in a way, that's what bond sales are for, because it's taking that that spending capacity out of the economy, which could create shortages and lead to inflationary pressures. Well, but
the
continuing
next thing to peddle the myth about taxes. Sorry, carry on.
No, she's continuing to peddle, and she did today, peddle the myth about taxpayers' money, and we're going to have to raise tax. I mean, indeed, the Tories are playing the same game. I mean, because they were saying, oh, she'll be coming back in the autumn with more taxes to pay for this spending spree that she's gone. It's hardly a spending spree. Actually, if you look at the departments overall, most of the departments have seen a cut. I mean, there's been some areas of increase within those departments, but overall, there has been a reduction. The NHS has seen an increase, but it's not enough. The real winner is the military.
Well, look, the Lib Dem, Ed Davey, today made a very important point. What is the point, he said, of trying to fix the NHS when the whole issue of social care hasn't been addressed? What would you do?
Well, I mean, we need a national care service. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that's the issue of our time. Like the National Health Service was crucially important, and it was the appropriate thing to do back when it was created in 1948. We now need a national care service. I mean, there is an emergency, frankly, you know, and it's absolutely outrageous that people, you know, who've scrimped and saved and worked hard, and I'm talking about, you know, particularly working class people who maybe have bought their council house, you know, and obtained a capital asset for the first time, perhaps in their family's history, and they then get to the other end of their life, and then are having to sell their home in order to pay for their care. This is absolutely outrageous. I mean, care should be free at the point of need, as the National Health Service, you know, is, and although there are areas where you have to pay. So absolutely, it needs to be brought into, we need a national care service run by the public sector, as the National Health Service should be run by the public sector, because much of it has already been hived off to the private sector, to American insurance health companies and so on.
Well, I can remember around about 2010, all the local elderly care homes here in Bristol being sold off.
Well, absolutely. Look, I mean, you know, the care that we provided, I mean, I think did need to be updated. I mean, it wasn't by virtue of flogging it off. I mean, I was a big advocate when I was leader of the council in Derby of the extra care schemes, whereby you kind of build a complex where people have their own flat, their own space, but there are health professionals and carers on site, if you like, who can provide the support and help that, you know, as and when people need it. But people have that independence and that dignity of having their own home, as it were, within a kind of sheltered environment. And that's the sort of area where I think, you know, we should be expanding and also providing greater support for people to be able to remain in their own home. Because I think, given the choice, most people would sooner stay in their family home. I mean, I know it's only bricks and mortar, but I mean, I've lived in a place now where for a long, long time, nearly 30 years, my late wife's ashes are buried in the garden. We have an attachment to this place. And, you know, we shouldn't have to just sort of flog it off. I'd like to think, you know, it could remain in the family after we've gone. And of course, you know, we see people in the public sector, public housing. I mean, they don't even have that option. I mean, and one of the things I did when I was chair of housing in Derby and maintained the policy when I was leader was to enable council tenants, or should I say children of council, elderly children of council tenants whose parents passed away, were able to succeed to the tenancy. I think that policy has been changed now since I've, you know, longer on the council. So you get a situation now where, you know, somebody loses their parent and they then have a letter from the local authority, you know, expressing sympathies, etc. The next breath, they're actually going to evict them, you know, to make way for a family, perhaps, you know. I mean, my view was, when I was chided by the officers who were opposed to the policy that I introduced, that because there was a shortage of houses, I made the point, well, it's not their fault. It's the government's fault that, you know, housing hasn't been provided, and they shouldn't be penalised, and we shouldn't be treating, you know, children of council tenants any different to the children of people who are the children of owner occupiers, you know. So, you know, I just think we should be creating, a decent society. We are the sixth biggest economy in the world, Tony. You know, we should have the best public services. We should have the best infrastructure in the world. But we've got the very, not necessarily the very worst, but certainly crumbling infrastructure, public services on their knees. You know, it's an absolute disgrace that we haven't got the quality of services and infrastructure in Britain, thanks to an agenda that's been pursued by both Labour and Tory governments for the last 50 years.
Okay, well, you touched briefly on, I think I interrupted you, but you were starting to talk about defence, because it's quite clear over the last couple of weeks that the NATO is insisting that the member states massively increase, particularly France, Germany and Britain, their defence spending.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they're creating a very hazardous world. And I mean,
well, hang on, they're saying that the hazardous world is out there. They haven't created it, but we need to be ready for it.
Well, that's of course nonsense, isn't it? Just do the body count, look at the number of wars and regime change operations that the United States and Britain for that matter.
Well, hang on, because Putin did invade Ukraine. I mean, we can't just stand by.
Well, I mean, I think you need to go back a little bit further and look at the fact that the United States and the European Union supported a coup that was actually the Maidan coup in Ukraine in 2014, led by literal Nazis to overthrow the democratically elected president, whatever you thought of him, was a democratically elected president of Ukraine, and then banned the Russian language, and then started in East Ukraine, throughout Ukraine, but in East Ukraine, where predominantly people are Russian speaking. In fact, indeed, one in three people in Ukraine are Russian speaking. Their first language is Russian. That was banned by the coup regime. They then started a civil war against East Ukraine. I mean, thousands of people lost their lives prior to Russia's special military operation. And indeed, immediately prior to the action that that Russia took in February 2022, Zelensky's forces were massing on the borders of the Donbas for a huge offensive. And indeed, I mean, the war should have never started. I mean, look, Russia put forward a peace and security proposition in November, I think it was, of 2021, and it was just thrown in the bin. I mean, it didn't give it house room. NATO were looking for this war. This is a proxy war. I mean, indeed, the Atlantic Council was essentially the kind of think tank for NATO. I mean, they were publishing articles talking about the strategic case for risking war with Russia. I mean, it was all very clear. They wanted to destabilize Russia. They wanted to overthrow Putin. And ultimately, they wanted to balkanize Russia. I mean, it's obviously rich in natural resources, raw materials and so on. And they'd love to balkanize Russia.
Let me suggest to them that they are going to have a real hard job there, because the Russians are absolutely 100% solid. And they're also way ahead in technology. Not only that, they've got a political system, generally speaking, which the people of the country are very supportive of, in contrast to ours. But look, okay, so given that defence spending is going to increase, we've also got some increase in spending on education. So with Rachel Reeves concentrating on health and education, surely this is a good spending review.
It's woefully inadequate, though, isn't it? Nowhere near enough for the requirements that the country needs. I mean, our schools are crumbling. The pupil-teacher ratio is ridiculously high. And teachers are not valued. They're not paid appropriately. We should be looking to increase the remuneration for people in the public sector, particularly people like teachers, nurses, and doctors, and so on. I mean, again, I'm going back, to looking through my rose-tinted spectacles. I don't think they are rose-tinted. I do think this is a reality. Going back to when I was at school, I mean, teachers, were seen as the pillars of the community. They had a status which they don't enjoy today. And with that status went a very good remuneration package. And, most of the experienced teachers at my school, lived in, four and five bedroom detached homes. That's kind of an impossibility now for teachers of today. It's an absolute disgrace. So, we should be investing in our public services, investing in our in the people that work in them. We need more of those people. We need massive investment in our infrastructure, and we need to build new schools. We need to build better roads, better rail infrastructure, etc. The rolling stock is shocking. The industry should be brought into public ownership, as should all the utilities be brought back into public ownership. We should be throwing the privateers out of the National Health Service, and indeed all of the public services where the private sector have got their sticky fingers into and have done, for, the best part of 50 odd years or so. Look, public services should be about delivering public service to the people of the country, not generating private profit. But I'm regret to say that is how it is operated up and down the country. And that's why we have these huge problems. And given that the government, as I've already mentioned, issues the currency, so money is literally no object for the government, I mean, when Rachel Reeves talks about a £22 billion black hole, it's just a lie. It's absolute nonsense.
Well, okay, let's get into some of this, Chris, because it's fascinating to hear some people saying that there, in fact, is a magic money tree. Would you agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it a magic money tree. I mean, the fact is that Britain has, had a floating fiat currency since 1971 after Richard Nixon scrapped what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which linked pound sterling to the dollar. That was jettisoned in 1971. And so essentially the value of the currency now is based on the credibility of the government. I mean, it used to have to be backed by gold. I mean, that is no longer the case anymore. And therefore, governments do have the ability to invest. And as I've already said again, Tony, the only restriction on their ability to spend is the availability of real resources in the economy. When I say real resources, what I'm talking about there is the availability of workers, the availability of raw materials, the availability of capital equipment, infrastructure, and so on. And if you are spending at a level which exceeds the capacity of the economy to absorb that spend, you then create inflationary pressures because you'll be then competing with the private sector for these scarce resources. And the government, even in those circumstances, though, is able to use the taxation system to make sure that they can provision themselves to, as it were, have the investment to proceed with their priority, their spending priorities, by taxing the competition from the private sector. But we're nowhere kind of near that level at this moment in time. But we do have an issue in terms of the availability of, just train up people. You can't just sort of turn the tap on overnight. But there are definitely things that could and indeed should be done right now. And one of those things, for example, is bringing all these utilities back into public ownership.
It's quite an interesting concept, the idea that actually the government and the Bank of England really is in charge rather than the city.
Well, the Bank of England, I forget, is owned by the government. I mean, it's not a separate entity. It's owned by the government.
Well, yes, but it doesn't seem to be doing necessarily what the people wish. And it's interesting this week, Chris, that we've also had the Reform UK weighing in, saying actually there's some fundamental problems with Andrew Bailey and the Bank of England. He has been forced in the Times to defend payments for deposits that arose from QE, saying that they're important for financial stability. Reform are saying that the Bank of England is saying they have no plans to stop paying interest on lenders' deposits, despite having been accused by the Reform of unnecessarily wasting tens of billions of pounds of taxpayers' money paying interest on money that they've borrowed for quantitative easing under the Bank.
Well, they haven't borrowed it, though.
Can I just let me finish? This is a little quote from the Times saying, under the bank's quantitative easing program, which lasted from 2009 to 2021, roughly £900 billion was created by buying bonds from commercial lenders, which then deposit the money they received at the central bank. Interest is now paid on these reserves, which stand at around £700 billion at the base rate of 4.25%. So Tyson and Farage are saying, cancel this. Just pay them straight from the Bank of England. Pay off all these loans, because this interest payment is part of the reason why the country's are having so many financial problems. And anyway, they should never have borrowed this money in the first place. They should have just spent it themselves.
Well, they don't borrow it, do they? I mean, it's a misnomer to call it borrowing, because what they're doing is selling bonds. They're selling bonds. They don't have to sell bonds. They're not obliged to sell bonds. They don't, they don't need to get money from the private sector or whatever by selling the bonds in order to resource the government's spending program. That's not what it's for. I mean, it's really corporate welfare, and the kind of ironically, what Farage and company are saying is absolutely right. Apart from the reference to taxpayers' money, I mean, that's another myth. There's no such thing as taxpayers' money. I mean, tax doesn't, as I've said, provision the government spending program. It's there to address inflation. It's there to deal with inequality. To actually tackle. I mean, like things like a wealth tax, for example, is important in terms of, clipping the wings of these very, very powerful oligarchs. I mean, this is what taxation is for. I mean, also, to drive spending patterns in certain directions. You know, for example, you know, you see the tax on cigarettes, for example, to deter people from smoking.
But the main problem is everyone seems to be in a consensus that we don't have enough money. What Reform is saying, and what you seem to be implying too, is that they just simply want the bank to do away with these interest payments. Other advocates of cutting reserve remuneration is what they call it in the UK, include Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister, and two former deputy governors of the Bank of England, Sir Paul Tucker and Sir Charlie Bean. So it does seem as if there could be, right at the very top, in the Bank of England and in the Treasury, some absolutely fundamental errors that are being made that would make it possible for tens of billions of pounds to be saved from the annual budget.
They could, absolutely. Look, I'm not sure it's errors. I think it's kind of deliberate, frankly. But what we've got to try and do is to erode this myth about the way in which the government spending program, the way the economy works. I mean, I always quote Henry Ford, who said about 100 years ago that if people understood how the banking and the monetary system operated, there'd be a revolution by tomorrow morning. And I always say our job is to create that revolution. But the whole notion of taxpayers' money, taxes funding government spending, of the government borrowing. And these things, I mean, it's a misnomer, as I've already said, it's not borrowing, they're actually selling bonds. I mean, they'd have to sell the bonds. I mean, they could just engage in what's known as overt monetary financing by just, you know, investing directly into the infrastructure and so on. And interestingly as well, many of the bonds that were purchased during the COVID period, and indeed during the financial crash, were actually purchased by the Bank of England. You know what I mean? So essentially, they were just creating money. It was just a kind of paper exercise. It's a bit like, you know, you having a fiver in your left-hand pocket and you transfer it to your right-hand pocket and say that your right-hand pocket's borrowed £5, but actually the right pocket and the left pocket is in the same pair of trousers owned by you. You don't owe anybody anything, really. You've just done a kind of a...
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. I also just like to round up, Chris, by talking about some of the people now who are being told about personal independence payments. This is disabled people around the country are being moved off of PIP. I have a personal someone I know, friend here in Bristol, who she was distraught. She was crying in the job centre. She said, "I cannot survive if you're going to force me to halve the amount of money. I just simply won't be able to live. I won't be able to, you know, I'll be a prisoner in my own home," and this sort of thing. And eventually the security guards literally picked her up and carried her out and dropped her on the doorstep. Now, this is disabled people now being told, actually, you're fit and you're not only not disabled, but you're also fit for work. And if you don't like it, then you're going to have to go and figure out how to appeal, and we're not going to help you.
No, it's criminal. And, you know, I used to work as a welfare rights officer many moons ago. And, you know, local authority, I worked for the local authority, Derbyshire County Council. This is before I was while I was a council on Derby City Council for a period of time, I was also a welfare rights worker for Derbyshire County Council. But, of course, because of the cutbacks that local authorities have experienced now, I mean, many local authorities have massively cut back. If they ever had a welfare rights department, they've cut back hugely the number of people doing that job. And so people have got nowhere to turn to. And because of the cutbacks as well, you know, the voluntary sector, like the Citizens Advice Bureau, they've seen reductions in funding from local authorities. Because of the restrictions that were imposed on legal aid, I know that the CAB, Citizens Advice Bureau, did actually secure quite substantial funding through the legal aid system. That's gone now. So, you know, this is a perfect storm for some of the most vulnerable people in society.
Well, this is the point, isn't it? Actually, it's the most vulnerable who are least able to cope when they're told, right, that's it.
Yeah, it's disgraceful. And they got, who do they turn to? The welfare rights departments have gone, or they're very, very hard pressed. CABs are closing down or massively reduced. The law centres, similarly. You know, it's a terrible situation. And, you know, you keep coming back to the point that we're a wealthy country, the sixth biggest economy in the world. Nobody should be living in poverty in this country. We should eradicate poverty. You know, we should eradicate the housing crisis. Everybody should have a decent home. Everybody should be, you know, have a reasonable standard of living. Everybody should have access to employment and be able to retire in dignity, have good quality public services. This isn't a pie in the sky. This is doable. This is achievable with the right sort of political will and recognising.
Well, so why is it that people last July in 2024 elected the Labour Party to literally to look after poorer people who become victims of the Conservatives? But actually, Labour seems to be doubling down on the wealth divide, actually saying, well, sorry, if you're not productive, we're not going to help you.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, people were conned. I mean, I think, you know, people have traditionally seen Labour as the, you know, the alternative to the Conservative Party, the sort of party which, you know, originally was established to stand up for the working class. It was born out of the trade union movement, wasn't it, of course? But it's lost its way. I mean, massively lost its way. I mean, it started to lose its way. Well, I mean, some would argue actually it lost its way from the get-go, but, I mean, I don't necessarily want to be that hard, but definitely from 1976, when Dennis Healey went to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise, that's where things really started to go wrong. And, you know, the quid pro quo of getting a loan from the IMF, which was never needed, it was absolutely absurd, and Dennis Healey never drew it down and said, subsequently acknowledged that it was a mistake. He acknowledged it was a mistake for the wrong reasons, but he did acknowledge it was a mistake. But the quid pro quo was, as is always the case when any country goes to the IMF, is that they insist on austerity measures and privatizations and all the rest of it, you know. And that led directly to the so-called winter of discontent in 1979. And, you know, the rest is history. I mean, that led Thatcher into office. You know, she then won a landslide in 1983, ironically, with a smaller share of the vote than she achieved in 1979. But because of the Social Democratic Party that was established with the express purpose of stopping a socialist government coming to power, because if you remember back then, Michael Foot had been elected as the leader of the Labour Party in 1981, and Labour was putting forward a socialist programme, you know, similar to what Jeremy Corbyn was proposing. And they were determined, you know, to stop a socialist government coming to power, and they took a lot of Labour votes and let the Tories come through the middle. So
when are we going to see a Workers' Party Prime Minister, Chris, finally?
Well, I'd like to think, you know, in the not-too-distant future, but, you know, we are up against it in terms of the establishment, and, you know, we saw what they did to Jeremy Corbyn with a relatively modest programme, let's be honest about it. The entire media, of course, was turned against him. And indeed, in 2024, because the establishment saw Sir Keir Starmer as a safe pair of hands. Yeah. You know, they gave him an easy ride, and they smoothed the way for the Labour Party back into office. But people weren't that convinced. If you look at the votes that Labour secured, I mean, I think it was less than 1 in 5 of the population voted for them. And of those that did vote, they only got, I think it was just over 32%.